Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is an episode about Lovecraft's Dreamland Realm. As we continue going along the storyline, I guess, or the setting, rather, of Dreamland Realm, I keep sort of being afraid that I'm going to get more spoilers and more spoilers into the narrative, and I'm trying to avoid that, and I think I'm avoiding it fairly well because I'm not really drawing that many connections. In this particular episode, there are going to be some connections that are going to get drawn, and so you might consider them spoilers. I don't think they're really horrible spoilers, but I'm just remembering when I was first reading the book, The Dream Quest of for the Unknown Kadeth, everything is a surprise. So if you're hearing this and you intend to read Kadeth, then possibly you will want to not listen to this episode right now. Okay, so if you're still here, you're okay with having certain details about the Dream Quest of the Unknown Kadeth somewhat spoiled for you. So in this episode, we're going to talk about the culture of the moon. So the moon in the Dream Quest of the Unknown for the Unknown Kadeth is a setting, and it is more or less like the moon of the Earth, except that it's, that turn-of-the-century kind of fantastical moon that you see in movies, in old silent films like La Voyage dans la Moon by Georges Méliès, and that you read about in, for instance, Jules Verne, From Earth to the Moon and Around the Moon. So by modern standards, pretty silly stuff, because we know so much about the moon that they didn't know when they were writing these things. So if you can get past that, or if you can think of the moon as being something else or some place else, and rather than being a literal moon, being something else, just a different, you know, a region very high up on some plateau maybe, or a floating sort of land above the surface of your campaign setting, you know, some kind of maybe like Roger Dean-esque floating inverted mountains with a whole world on top of them. So you could do something like that, I think, and probably fare better than saying this is the literal moon, just because at least me myself, I find those turn of the century moon fantasy realms pretty funny and pretty silly and pretty cheesy. So anyway, it's the moon as written, so that's how we'll talk about it now. But how you treat that in your own canon is obviously your own business. So in the Dreamland realms, the moon possesses a secret and mysterious side, which is always turned away from the Earth, and which no fully human person, save perhaps the dreamers Snirith Co. and Carter himself, the protagonist of the Dream Quest for Unknown Kadeth, has ever beheld. There are two ways to reach the moon that we know of. Its natives sail to it in their galleons from Dilith Lean, and you'll recall possibly from episode 2 when we first visited Dilith Lean that there were some merchants that came to Dilith Lean in great black galleons trading in rubies, and no one really liked them all that much because they seemed a little bit weird, a little bit different, and they didn't tend to frequent the local merchants, so people didn't really consider it very profitable, necessarily, to deal with these merchants, and yet at the same time they continued to deal with the merchants because they really liked the rubies. So they're great to buy from, they're just not really all that great to sell to. Although they do sell They do sell slaves to them, if you'll recall, men from Parg. But the black galleons that these merchants come in, these particular merchants, are capable of sailing to the moon through a cataract on the Earth. So if you travel west, and we'll talk a little bit about this in the Southern Sea episode, but if you travel past the basalt pillars of the west, beyond which simple folk say splendid Cathuria lies, but which wise dreamers well know are the gates of a monstrous cataract wherein the oceans of Earth's dreamland drop wholly to abysmal nothingness, shooting through the empty spaces toward other worlds and other stars, and the awful voids outside the ordered universe. So in other words, it's this sort of gaping black hole, or a dimensional portal, torn into the fabric of the Southern Sea. And if you sail into it, you will end up in the void around the Dreamlands, which I believe we covered in episode 2. The void around the Dreamlands makes it difficult or impossible to, well, not impossible because it happens in the story, but basically impossible to reach other Dreamlands from one Dreamland. It's a void filled with god larvae and the crawling chaos Nyarlathotep. So people tend to avoid it, but these merchants on these great galleons venture to sail through this portal and arrive on the moon. So I would say that if your player attempts to do this, to make this journey, whether it's to the literal moon or whether you've just made it a different realm, a different dimension, or a different, just a different sort of land, maybe a floating land mass, or whatever you do. If the players go through this portal, I would say that they would need to make a will check to resist the fear condition, and probably also a fortitude check to resist a 50% chance of 1d4 damage at the hands of the unseen larval godlings that cross into the material plane at that point, or they linger, I guess, in within this void. Those are mentioned specifically in the book, and the fact that they are able to do damage to people is mentioned, so it's probably something that you would want your players to be subject to. Now, the cats of Ulthar are also able to reach the moon by passing through shadows, and you may remember, again, from episode 2 when we spoke about Ulthar, that cats dwell in the shadows there, and cats are quite mysterious and seem to use shadows for something more than just sort of hiding in. And indeed, as it turns out, as it's revealed later in the book, and again, for not spoiling things, I tried to save this for later episodes, which you're now experiencing. But the cats actually use shadows as kinds of portals through space. So they can leap through a shadow and end up, for instance, on the moon, or back on Ulthar, or whatever. And they are not subject to the void that way. They don't pass through the void. They go straight from one place to another. As far as we know, only the cats have this ability, and they can bring friends along for the ride, but I don't see how a human would know how to do that inherently. Although I think that it could be kind of cool to have possibly a tabaxi know how to do this. I mean, maybe they don't even know themselves that they know how to do it, but they could end up knowing how to do it. A tabaxi, if you're not familiar with them, they're feline humanoids. They came about way back in first edition, from what I understand, in a publication called The Fiend Folio. and they have since become, well, they've gone in and out of being a playable race. It kind of depends on what kind of supplements you're using. If you're playing a game where they are playable, then I think that would be a perfectly reasonable thing for a Tabaxi to just have an innate, possibly, as I said, unknown ability that, oh, they can go through shadows just like the Cats of Ulthar can. What do you know? And if you're not, then they still may be a monster in a campaign, so they still may have that ability if you choose to give them that capability. If you're curious about Tabaxi stats, I'm sure you can find them online. I'm sure they're all over the place online. I don't need to tell you that, though. The place that I have it written down and refer to it myself is a publication called 5th Edition Foes, which is by Necromancer Games. Page 220, Tabaxi. But, I mean, that's going off script. Lovecraft did not write about half feline, half human creatures. I was just kind of taking the idea of cats having special knowledge about portal travel through shadows and running with it. But now returning to the source. So on the far side of the moon there are ruins from an older civilization that we know nothing about. Lovecraft wrote nothing about why these ruins were there. However, the dead temples on the mountains were so placed that they could have glorified no suitable or wholesome god. And in the symmetries of the broken columns, there seemed to be some dark and inner meaning which did not invite solution. So in other words, the ruins are, they have a certain evil feeling to them and a certain kind of almost puzzle to them that you just kind of know you'll never really understand. The sky on the dark side of the moon is black and strewn with stars, even though the sun shines scorchingly in the sky. So there's the sun, but it has no atmosphere, so that's kind of something that we're used to. And again, if I was doing this, it wouldn't be the moon, it would just be a floating landmass above my campaign world, but it would be high enough in the sky that no one has really noticed it before. It's not something that you look up and you see, because it's way the heck up there, and it's so close to the atmosphere, the edge of the atmosphere, that, yeah, you do just see the darkness of space rather than a blue sky. The sea on the moon is oily and sluggish. That said, the moon inhabitants use it for transportation quite effectively, so it's not so sluggish, for instance, that you can't row in it. It's just thicker than the water on Earth. The far side is populated. Its inhabitants live in low, broad, round cottages in fields of grotesque, whitish fungi. These cottages have no windows. In fact, most buildings on the moon have no windows. It's not really explained why that is, it's just they don't have windows. Upon jagged hills of a leprous-looking coast are the gray, windowless towers that lean and bend, clustered together in an unnatural and unsettling way. So I think that if I were running this, players would have to make a fortitude save to overcome the mental effects of the city's architecture, and maybe a fortitude save to overcome its stench, because it is stated a couple of times that these merchants in their galleons is just an unbearable stench comes up from the underside of the galleons, the lower decks, and indeed the moon has that same stench all around all the time. Now beyond the city that we see in the book are hillside forests containing some of the same trees that the Zoogs tapped for their special gourd, or their wine that they put into gourds and sort of give to visitors. And that is because, if you'll recall from episode 2, the tree in the Enchanted Wood was said to have sprung from a seed dropped by someone on the moon. And that's why there are trees on the moon that match that one in the Enchanted Wood, because, yes, indeed, one seed dropped down to Earth and planted that seed. Okay, so there's one known humanoid life form dwelling on the dark side of the moon. They are natural shapeshifters, at least to some degree, and it's a bit confusing to understand what their shapeshifting ability really is. It's very unclear as to whether they're just sort of formless, or rather, they're not super solid in what shape they take, or whether they can actually, like, shapeshift like you see in the movies. It's very, very hazy and fuzzy on that point. But these shapeshifters, these moon beings, which Lovecraft declines to give a name, so we can call them moon beings, we can call them toad-like things, we can call them... Yeah, those are the two names, actually, that he uses. They mostly serve Nyarlathotep, the chaotic evil god of chaos. So they are very, very much aware that that's the god that they serve. They are almost protectors of the elder gods in general, and they seek to dissuade, by force when necessary, anyone who would disturb the gods. And that is something that they do consciously. It is a mission that they have. They are a group of beings that essentially, yeah, protect the elder gods from being disturbed. If you've ever seen Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, you might recall the Brotherhood of the Cruciform Sword, the freelance guys who go around making sure that nobody finds the Grail, essentially. That's kind of how I see these moon beings. They protect the interests of the elder gods, probably without actually knowing that that's what the elder gods actually want. But they are in very close communion with Nyarlathotep. They absolutely serve Nyarlathotep, and they have access, as far as we can tell, straight to Nyarlathotep. They can bring people who should not be disturbing the elder gods to Nyarlathotep to be consumed. So that's they have a very close communion with at least the chaotic evil god Nyarlathotep. So these moon beings are grayish white, they're slippery things, their blood is of green ichor, and by default they resemble toads without eyes. At the end of their snouts, they have a mass of vibrating, short, pink tentacles. They are naturally stronger than most humans, with dexterous paws. They're able to leap great distances, and it is said that their forms are not consistent. So I gather from that they are some kind of shape-shifting beast. And again, how much they can shape-shift is really up to your imagination. If you want to make them something that can do a perfect copy of a being, then maybe that's something that you would want to let them do. Maybe you wouldn't want them to. Maybe their shapeshifting is just the ability to change between a more human and a more toad-like form, depending on their terrain. That's kind of the way that I went, because I didn't have enough data in my for my stat block that I devised for the moon beings. I didn't really have enough data to definitively say, for instance, that they could change to match exactly a human. And in fact, there's an argument that they probably cannot do that, because they use humans or human-like creatures to interface with actual humans on Earth. So if they were able to just shapeshift into a perfect form of a human, you would imagine that they wouldn't need to capture humans to be their go-between. Now, the counter-argument to that is that possibly they could look like a human, but they couldn't mimic human behavior well enough to fool humans into thinking, hey, I'm a normal human being. So it's really, really fuzzy, and you can just kind of come up with your own answer as to why they don't interface with humans directly, and you can decide on how much they can shapeshift. I decided that since Lovecraft definitely writes that they are toad-like sometimes and less toad-like other times, that they can at least shift their form, and he describes their form as being soft and kind of malleable. So I take it to mean that they can change their form in ways enough to adapt to a terrain that might be more beneficial to them under certain circumstances. So for my stat block for moon beings, I award 600 XP with a CR rating of 3, just because they can adapt so well. They are chaotic evil. They are medium monstrous humanoids. Initiative plus 1. Senses are blind sense up to 30 feet, dark vision up to 60 feet, perception plus 6. Defenses, their AC is 16, with a touch of 11 and flat-footedness of 15, and then their HP is 15. Fortitude is plus 4, reflex is plus 4, will is plus 4. Offense, speed of 30 feet, climbing 15 feet. For attacks, they've got melee with a javelin, which is straight out of Lovecraft. They are known to use javelins as one of their primary weapons. So they've got melee javelin plus 4, which is a 1d8 plus 3 damage die. Now, their ranged attack, I think technically, I mean, the only thing Lovecraft ever wrote in terms of weaponry for them were javelins, but the extension of that for me is a heavy crossbow. So for a ranged attack, heavy crossbow plus 3, 1d10, and a crit at 19 to 20. 1d10 damage, obviously. So statistics, strength 15, dex 13, con 15, intelligence 15, wisdom 13, charisma 6. And I feel like their charisma has to be very, very low, because they are described as being pretty horrific. They clearly avoid humans for some reason, so I'm assuming it's linked to the fact that they just can't pass for human to save their life. Their base attack bonus, if you're playing Pathfinder, plus 2, CMB plus 4, CMD 15. Feats, things like dodge, things like that. They can leap, and they're dexterous. I get from Lovecraft that they're pretty good at avoiding harm. Now, a lot of that is because they cower behind their slaves, but I think if in battle, they might be able to do that. Skills, perception plus 6, stealth plus 6, survival plus 6. Languages, I figure maybe they could speak common in a pinch. Lunar would be their primary language. Special abilities, mimicry. Is a moon being is proficient in all weapons, armor, and shields. A moon being can use any spell trigger or spell completion item as if that spell were on its own list, with a caster level equal to its racial hit dice. That's something I ripped off of the doppelganger from the Pathfinder bestiary. And the imperfect copy ability is a moon being can change its shape between a toad-like and human-like form to better adapt to its current terrain. Weaknesses is breathing skin. Because an amphibious creature's skin aids in its breathing, it takes a minus 2 penalty on fortitude save throws against gases or contact and inhaled poisons and any other inhaled effect. And this I took out of the Advanced Bestiary Template Guide from Green Ronin, I think it is. Yeah, A Monster Template Compendium, Advanced Bestiary by Green Ronin Publishing. They have a great section on amphibious modifications to creatures, so that kind of comes from that. So those are the moon beings, and they are the upper class of the moon population. They are the native inhabitants of the moon, as far as we know. I mean, we don't know that they're not, anyway. We don't know what that old civilization is, but that's kind of how they're presented as being moon beings. So they are the upper class. They do all of the administrative work. They are the officers and the administrators and navigators and so on. They also keep a couple of different slaves. So the one notch under the moon beings themselves are the earthling slaves. Well, they're both earthling slaves. So these are our slaves, and again, this is a little bit spoilery, but these are humanoids. They're underdeveloped humanoids, so they don't actually look all that much like a human, and yet they are. So they're from the land of Leng. And Leng, I can't remember if I mentioned it in episode 2 or not. I feel like I didn't, because we never got that far down the Southern Sea. But Leng is a kind of, it's a very mysterious land, something with great evil around it. So the inhabitants of Leng appear mostly human, with the notable exception that their mouths are unsettlingly wide and their heads are slightly misshapen. And, I mean, they pass for human, Because technically, as far as I can tell, they are human, but they're super deformed. So they wear turbans to disguise the shape of their heads, and they are the merchants that come to Dilithleen to trade in rubies. Now these rubies, as it turns out, come from the moon, and these merchants are not actually from the moon. I mean, they come from the moon, but they're not natives to the moon. They're actually just slaves of the moon beings, and they are made to serve as merchants on these galleons, and they're told to interact with humans, because that's kind of, because they are human, and that's what the moon beings need, is people to talk to the humans and convince the humans that this is all a completely normal and non-weird ruby merchant ship. So Leng is, as I say, a land shrouded in mystery, so there's not a whole lot of data about it, and the data that we do have about the inhabitants of Leng all sort of branch from this subset of Leng folk who really come to us by way of the moon. You think they're actually of the moon for quite some time in the book, and then you learn later that they're actually not from the moon. They just happen to have been enslaved by people on the moon. And that's why they appear, you know, that's why they're on galleons that come from the moon. So it's kind of nice because we have a couple of different stats for these people. And one of them comes from the Kobold Press bestiary called Tome of Beasts, or Monster Manual, whatever we call it. It's called the Tome of Beasts. I'm just wondering what the generic term for that is. And so the Folk of Leng, they're on page 205, if you happen to have that, the Tome of Beasts, or if you get a copy of it, look on 205. And the people of Leng are hideous and malevolent, with goat-like legs and small horns they keep concealed beneath turbans, mouths full of rows of serrated teeth somewhat akin to sharks. They have a fondness for combining heavy leathers and bright silks in their robes, and they always go forth masked when leaving their mysterious chilled cities. Now that's a little bit of artistic license. I think that Lovecraft didn't quite describe them that way, but it's not a horrible way to describe them. It's kind of cool, and the artwork is kind of interesting. I really like the way that they portray these people. You can see how it would be very unsettling to deal with them. You might think, sure, they're human, but you would definitely think they're a little bit strange. So, the Folk of Leng, as statted out in the Tome of Beasts, are medium humanoid neutral evil. Their armor class is 14. Their hit points, 68, which is 8d8 plus 32. And their speed is 30 feet. Strength is 12, dex is 15, con is 18, intelligence 14, wisdom 16, charisma 22, and I feel like that's probably pretty important to have a high charisma on these guys, because they do have to pass themselves off as human. Now, part of the thing that they do is they sell these rubies, which people in Dilithleen really, really like. So part of their charisma, I feel, comes from just the fact that they've got some stuff that nobody else can get. And it's acknowledged in the book when Carter, the protagonist of the Unknown Caedith book, goes back to Dilithleen to tell people, hey, you really shouldn't do any more business with these people. Everyone agrees, but declines. They say, yeah, we shouldn't, but you know what? Those rubies are so nice, we're just going to keep, we're going to keep doing business with them. And they do. So you can't, you know, you can lead the horse to water, but you can't make them drink. So there's a couple of different things that they give the Folk of Leng in the Tome of Beasts. They are immune to necrotic damage, which I think fits nicely in with their allegiance to Nyarlathotep. They're immune to fright, which I think is pretty, again, in line with their general feel in the source material. I think they could also be immune to, certainly, intoxication. Carter tries to ply one of them with the wine, the moon wine from the Zoogs, and it does nothing. So that's something to take into consideration. So that's the Lang folk from the Tome of Beasts. Now, the Tome of Beasts also provides a spider of Lang, which is kind of nice, and I won't get into that so much because we're talking about the moon beings specifically, or the people from Lang from the moon. So there's also some stats for Lang people in the frog or the necromancer games book, 5th edition Foes, and it gives stats for the denizen of Lang. And this denizen of Lang, wrapped from head to toe in tattered leather robes, this creature appears almost human at first glance. The longer one looks, however, the more one becomes aware of strange and terrifying realities beneath the facade. And again, I think that's pretty good. So, denizens of Lang, XP is 1800, a CR rating of 5. They classify these as medium aberrations. Initiative plus 4, AC 16, HP 85, saving throws, dex plus 7, resistance, cold and light damage, lightning damage, immunity, poison damage, poison and suffocation. The speed is 40 feet, and they attack with bites and claws. I'm not so sure about the attacking with bites and claws. Myself, the folk of Lang don't really get into battle directly. The moon beings do, and their chosen weapon is a javelin. So there's not a whole lot of data on what a denizen of Lang would actually use. But these stats provide biting and claws, which is fine. Strength is 14, dex is 18, con is 19. Intelligence is 18, wisdom 17, charisma 21. Again, high charisma. I think it's really something that you kind of have to go with based on the fact that this is kind of what they do. They trick people into doing business with them based on their pretty gems. So the Lang folk generally are either just called Lang folk or denizens of Lang, however you want to refer to them. In Lovecraft, he, before you find out that they are from Lang, he calls them almost human. That's what he generally sort of calls them, is just almost humans. So the almost humans are really denizens of Lang. And now you know. Now you know the truth. The lowest class on the moon are the Earthmen from Parg. And these men are enslaved. They're sold to the denizens of Lang for the moon beings. They take them back to the moon and enslave them. And that's all we know, really. We don't know exactly what they do, what purpose they serve. I mean, the denizens of Lang are essentially the link between the moon beings and humans. That's their function. We get that. What we don't know is what they're doing with these slaves that they take from Parg and take them back to the moon. That's something that's happening that we don't know a whole lot about. We also don't really know where Parg is, except that it's beyond a river past Dilithlene. And then last but not least are some allies of the moon beings, and the notable allies of moon beings, I mean, aside from Nyarlathotep himself, or itself, are rather the cats from Saturn. So these cats are not Earth cats, they are cats from Saturn. They are very large cats, and they are leagued by treaty with the inhabitants of the moon. We don't know where this treaty came from, or why it came about, but we do know that the cats of Saturn are in league by treaty with the moon beings, and they are therefore hostile toward Earthlings. Now, as far as we can tell, they aren't so hostile that they cause any real trouble for Earth. I mean, we don't read or hear about the cats of Saturn attacking the Dreamland realm, but we do know that if something attacks the moon beings on the moon, then the cats of Saturn are very likely to come and help. Conversely, we know from reading, from events in the book, that if someone attacks moon beings on Earth, the cats of Saturn don't come and help. So I don't know, obviously, how frequent, you know, how common that is, but from what I'm getting is it's that the cats of Saturn will help defend the moon, and that's about as far as they'll go. And I think we could even surmise that maybe they don't want to go to Earth because there are other dangers there, whereas the moon, probably a slightly more isolated and a sort of a known environment. So the cats of Saturn, as far as we know, are just larger cats. So any stat block for a leopard or a tiger or a panther or a cheetah, which, you know, there are just so many of those in all the bestiaries, you just kind of look around for cats and you'll find a cheetah and a leopard, certainly in the Paizo, the Pathfinder bestiary. There are a couple of sizable cats that you could steal stats from. And we don't really have any details about the cats of Saturn, honestly. It's just, it is simply stated that they are larger than the domesticated cat from Earth, and it is the impetus for the cats to leave the moon after rescuing, again, spoilers, after rescuing the protagonist. They specifically leave because they are afraid that the larger cats from Saturn are going to come and defend the moon beings. So there you go. That's what we know about that. And that's everything we know about the moon. In terms of the book itself, I mean, there aren't really any chapters, so it's hard to say how much of the book this took up. But I mean, it's a quick foray into this dark world where things are pretty darned evil. Everything on the moon seems to be quite evil and foreboding, and very much in the surface of Nyarlathotep. So it's a place that you would want to avoid, for sure. It's a place of chaotic evil. And it is in direct, I can't stress it enough, it's in direct service of Nyarlathotep. They are very much like the protectors of the Elder Gods, and they serve Nyarlathotep. They bring, I guess you could call them sacrifices, to Nyarlathotep. And maybe, who knows, maybe that's what the Earthmen of Parg are being sold into slavery for. Maybe they're going to go be sacrificed to Nyarlathotep. We're not really sure. What we do know is that it's an evil place full of toad-like creatures that mine rubies to sell to Earthmen so that they can get Earthmen in exchange. That's everything about the moon that I have for you. Thank you for listening. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.